one of the joys of being in this room is just to be able to hit that fireplace hood. That's actually, as I'm sure you may have known, is to alert the recording people back in the acoustical office that they will start the recorder. It's not to get your attention, really, but it does serve that purpose. Today we are continuing our series on family politics that make for peace, and our particular title today is Learning to be Peacemakers, the Nonviolent Solutions. Let us begin with prayer. Lord, you have called us to be your people and to live according to your love and purposes within families. It's a very difficult thing, and so often we are unequal to the task, and so often we sense our own despair and failure. But may we hang on to the hope that you give us, that your love, which forgives, also empowers us to be effective as well as faithful, for the sake of Christ, the head of the church and the head of our family. Amen. Every session, it would seem, we should again recommend books to you. Some of the books that we suggest are at the back on the table, so if you would like to look at those before you leave, why, again, we would encourage you to do that. Particularly today, there are three books that would be recommended in addition to Scripture that would have some kind of impact on how we might understand nonviolent solutions or that aspect of peacemaking in the family. One of those is PET in Action by Thomas Gordon. Another is in the book Caring Enough to Confront by David Augsburger. And I'll quote from that a little later on. Another is the book by Kathleen and James McGinnis, Parenting for Peace and Justice, which has a very good section toward the front about peacemaking, nonviolence in the family. I'd like to share one passage of Scripture that was shared yesterday as well, and that is from Ephesians 4, verses 13 through 16. And in doing this, I would like to reiterate what I believe is a very definite principle for what we understand about family in Scripture. And that is that the way a family lives together for those who follow the way of Christ is primarily according to the same kind of gospel and input that Christ gives the church. The family is a kind of sub-church. In fact, it's very interesting that in the New Testament, to a great extent, the early Christians gathered as house churches. It was the family that hosted others who were either investigating or committing themselves to the way of Christ. This is Ephesians 4, verses 13 through 16. And so we shall all come together to that oneness in our faith and in our knowledge of the Son of God. We shall become mature people, reaching to the very height of Christ's full stature. Then we shall no longer be children, carried by the waves and blown about by every shifting wind of the teaching of deceitful men, who lead others into error by the tricks they invent. Instead, by speaking the truth in a spirit of love, we must grow up in every way to Christ, who is the head. Under his control, all the different parts of the body fit together, and the whole body is held together by every joint with which it is provided. So when each separate part works as it should, the whole body grows and builds itself up through love. Then I would like to include with that a well-known section of the great love hymn of the New Testament from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 through 7. And this is about love. Love in the New Testament, as well as love, steadfast love in the Old Testament, covenant love, is always active. It's not some idea that we toss around in our minds and we banter about in discussion, but it's always what God plants in our midst that calls us to action, to act upon that which love means. Love is patient and kind. It is not jealous or conceited or proud. Love is not ill-mannered or selfish or irritable. Love does not keep a record of wrongs. Love is not happy with evil, but is happy with the truth. Love never gives up, and its faith, hope, and patience never fail. Love is eternal. When we attempt to live out the meaning of that love as peacemaking, even as Jesus said to us who are set in families, as well as otherwise in the church, blessed are the peacemakers, then we need to come to grips with what some of the difficulties might be in families. Now, just by way of review, I'm sure will recall, if you were here before, that we have chosen to use a concept that is quite significant for Thomas Gordon in parent effectiveness training or effectiveness training for Lutherans, that involves a window in which I can see the meaning of my relationships. And a family, of course, is a set of relationships. It's husband, wife, it's parents and children, and it may involve other people who are a part of the extended family as well. And this principle or concept applies to the way I see myself in the family or in any other relationship. And I believe it's very pertinent to the gospel of peacemaking in the family, that we can see that there are times when the other person in a relationship owns the problem. And a problem is that which gets us out of harmony, that really hinders that experience of shalom, of peacefulness within, and particularly socially in relationships. Then we say in this concept that in addition, hopefully more and more time, as we build each other up, every part fit together and growing in the love of Christ, that there will be no problem times. And that no problem times particularly are what we enjoy. The times of worship, the times of sharing, the times of play, the times of learning, the times of being in Holden, etc. Basically for us, those are probably really peaks of experience. And we want that kind of experience more and more. We regard that as a sign of the abundant life, that we can live together in peace and harmony in our relationships. But there are the knotty, pervading, continuing experiences of conflict. And so we do discover that at times in any relationship, as we are truthful and honest about it, that indeed we do have disagreements and conflicts where, as we look at our relationship with others through this window, we notice that there are behaviors about the life of the other that really infringe on us. We don't like it. We want it to change. We have either a kind of incensed conviction that it's immoral. We feel that we're interfered with in what we need to live. We have reasons of our own, and particularly feelings, emotions, that are, in fact, gifts of God that indicate all is not well in our relationships. We're out of balance or out of harmony. And then the question is, of course, what can we do together? Because it's always together, if we're going to be peacemakers, in order to change and bring back into shalom or harmony that relationship that is out of whack. So we own that problem, and we've already said that we can try to send I messages yesterday, and I'll abbreviate that with an I am, instead of you messages that are usually very heavily critical, blameful, or judgmental. And instead, we try to find ways of speaking the truth in love. Now, if it happens that the behavior of the other person persists, maybe I've sent a couple of I messages. We talked about lateness a few times yesterday. Maybe I have a friend or someone else in the family. We make appointments and they don't show up, especially on time. Perhaps also, as I continue to send the I message, the behavior becomes all the more solidified and stubborn. There just does not seem to be the responsiveness of the other people to the expression of my concern about how that behavior affects me. Now, we can look at ourselves, of course, and we can say, well, maybe I'm doing something in terms of the way I'm communicating. Maybe I'm not sending a good iMessage, for example. And by that I don't mean that I have to say when you each time and I feel each time and because in terms of how it affects me. But somehow my own communication is not getting through. So maybe I need to look at that and fix it a little bit. Maybe the other person really does not at all admit to himself or herself that the behavior that bothers me really has any effect on me and says, well, you know, I'm just going to blow that off. I don't believe you should get all upset about that, Mom or Dad. You know, I'm going to keep doing it. And we get incensed as parents, for example, or as friends or whatever the relationship and say, but that's not enough for me. I have a firmness about what I expect in the relationship. I do want this situation changed. And in the truthfulness and the balance of the relationship, I must continue to persist that we might have nonviolent solutions and have a peaceful relational ending to the conflict. So I've tried everything, and the problem persists. So what do I do next? Very crucial question. What do I do next? Now, in the history of our experience with each other, we have learned two primary ways of resolving the conflict. One way, and we're going to call it the authoritarian way, one way goes something like this in a diagram. I, a person in a relationship, and I'm going to draw myself large because I'm the parent, or I at least feel I have a great deal of size and importance in the relationship. I decide I'm going to settle this conflict once and for all. And so I draw myself up with the best powerful voice, and I simply tell the other person, look, this is the way it is. And one of my favorite remembrances from my childhood, my father was quite authoritarian in terms of how we settled disputes in the family. He really said, more or less, as long as you live under this roof, it's going to be done this way. Now, I imagine some of the rest of you heard that too. Okay, that can be very effective. It's particularly effective in terms of parent-child relationships of getting the result when the child is younger, because the child does not have very much power, humanly speaking, and isn't able to handle that so directly. The difficulty of that is at least twofold. If I believe that love does involve respect for all people in my family, because that is the new commandment of Christ for family relationships, then it does end up with someone winning and someone losing. And even more than that, in terms of the kind of scriptural reference we have to the meaning of relationships, one result of that is the feeling effect of the person who is the loser. What's that like if you lose? You ever lost? Yeah, I'm sure all of us have somewhere along the line. What does it feel like to lose? When someone just sort of lords it over you, which is an appropriate way to describe that, and says, points the finger, now do it, with a great deal of feeling and maybe some sanctions, some threats, some punishments to go along with it. What do you feel like at that point? Angry? Okay, anyone else?
Just rebellious?
Humiliated?
Frustrated,
etc. We could find biblical words that would match that from some of the scripture we've already said. Like discouragement or provoking to anger, etc. So out of that, and I'll just sum it up, usually there is some kind of resentment that ensues. And even though, for example, you can short sheet a bed because you want to have fun. Have you ever done that to somebody? I think that's so much fun to do. We enjoy that. You know, just as a kind of reminder of the humor of life. But if you do it in rebellion, it has a different meaning, doesn't it? For example, if you've ever gone to camp in the past, somewhere along the line, and you had a camp counselor that just didn't bend very much, and who just really seemed to enjoy towing the line, and you figured out what you could do to get back to that counselor, I would imagine. And the counselor probably didn't like it, but you said, I got even. He or she doesn't even know who did it, but boy, I got back. Okay, this happens in families as well, in this small, intimate group of people, or larger, that are living together as the body of Christ. Because we're talking about the Christian family at this point, not just any family out there, it's ours, and how we are responsible as stewards in the midst of it. Now, a second way that we also know something about, and which is usually quite deplorable for all of us, is the permissive way. Now, basically, this is how the permissive way of resolving conflicts in the family occurs. Maybe as a parent, or the powerful one in any relationship, I start out by saying, I really don't like what you're doing and I want it to change. Okay, now imagine a parent and a five-year-old, it's raining outside, and the kid wants, and it's, what, 52 degrees at that frozen thermometer over there at the dining hall, but the kid just wants to dart out without anything on, basically, no raincoat, no sweater, and just have a ball playing in the rain. And there you stand as a parent. So you say to the parent, I just can't take this. You're going to have to put a raincoat on and get a warm sweater under it. The kid says, make me. Well, nobody likes that. So you say, look, I really mean it. I want you to get that on. Well, I don't see why I need to do that. Johnny across the street is out playing. I can do it just as well. And so you begin to weaken a little bit and say, well, you know, I'm going to just be worried sick if you go out there without a raincoat on. It probably mean going to the doctor and so on. Kid says, that'll be your problem. That's not mine. And runs out the door. And you stand there as father or mother or as babysitter or as teacher or whatever similar kind of relationship experience. And you say, I don't like this. In fact, what it means is, essentially, as permissiveness in the relationship, is I feel very much like the loser. And the child, or whoever is the one that we would expect obedience and at least some involvement to make a decision that's fair, the child is essentially sending the solution back. And that child goes out probably thinking, well, I can sort of do anything I want. You know, I guess my parent really is not very strong. And that becomes a pattern that we label permissiveness. And that is a sign of decay in our culture. And it surely is also a sign of decay and irresponsibility in a Christian family. Because it does not measure up to the commandment of the love of Christ.
How do these kind of children fit in a school system? They're not very loved.
Yes, please.
Could you give an illustration of that between spouses? Or does that one not fit?
Sure.
Oh, of course.
Sure.
How? Could you illustrate that somehow? I can't figure it out.
Okay, let's see. Let's talk about the checkbook. You know, most marriages have a great deal of discussion from at least some time or other about the checkbook. And in our relationship,
let's use a hypothetical.
Oh, hypothetical. I thought at last we could resolve the conflict.
Well, this checkbook is one better. He wanted to do it about my snoring, and I absolutely refused. So.
I simply said to Mona, it's about time you become the one who has the problem. Okay. What would you like to do about this hypothetical then? Someone else's checkbook. Okay, a marriage is having some difficulty in its relationship because husband and wife are not really that clear about how to manage money. And so let's say the husband might be a stereo buff. And so he says, there's that stereo down at Stereo Electronics, and I really would like to have it. And, you know, it's one of these fancy ones with all the neatest components and 100 watts for each speaker. And you can see, you know, the eyes are glowing and the mouth is dripping of that expectation. But the wife says something like, well, now, I can't see that. You know, we, for one thing, need to do something in one of the children's rooms. I've been having this problem. We need some shelves, or we need stools. We need something to make it possible for the child to live better, to be more self-sufficient in terms of his or her living. And so the husband says, well, we can do that later. The wife says, well, we have only so much money. And the husband just insists, I'm going to go buy it or else. You know, I have $500 tucked away over here, and I'm going to spend it. Okay, in that case, you can reverse this, depending on which person you're looking at. But if you think of it from the wife's point of view, she's a loser. Because she has not persevered in terms of taking care of her own sense of responsibility as a person and in terms of the family. The husband appears to be the winner when he looks at himself, and the wife the loser. Usually what it means to be permissive is I start out, I do have authority, some sense of expertise, some sense of my powerfulness as a person and what that means, but I start to let go of it. I don't hold on to actually that principle of speaking the truth in love. I simply give up my responsibility of communication in that encounter, and then I'm left, I'm sure, in any husband-wife relationship, the loser, I am left with the same kind of resentment going back to the husband or the child or however the line of direction in any other relationship. Does that make it clear, Nan? Mm-hmm. Fits any relationship. It has to do with the way the two people deal with the conflict.
So basically, Jamie, a permissive way is when one party capitulates.
Right.
Just gives up.
Yeah, it's capitulation. It's not being faithful to what it means to be a significant part of the relationship. Now, we think of that primarily as children becoming permissive in their behavior, but we have to remember the children become permissive not genetically, but socially. Children learn what it means to be permissive. So our concern is, if we're going to be peacemakers and find nonviolent solutions, what is at least an alternative to that? So a third way of looking at methods, ways of being responsible as parents or as individuals in any relationship is to look at a non-violent, or we might call it a peacemaking, way of handling the conflict. And just to diagram that, it would go something like this. Regardless of the relationship and the age, etc., of the person. And by the way, it's very important to see this working just as well with, for example, our relationships with older people as it is to see that we're talking about, perhaps, parents and children. I think that's an area especially that is so important. As I go to nursing homes and I see often how the needs of older people are ignored who are there, I'm almost appalled. Because there is not the sense of finding peaceful solutions that take care of the older people. Very important thing to look at, I believe. So we're of equal importance in the sight of God, regardless of age. So this would suggest, if we're going to be peacemakers about it, that our communication is going to be at least primarily directed to our I messages, which are clear expressions of how the behavior is affecting me, and children learn this. I can surely vouch for that in terms of our family. The children begin to learn how to express themselves about what they need and what's fair and so on. And also, of course, especially, to remember the gift of love in a relationship that is listening. So it's not only confronting. I need to be aware that we can listen to each other, and the modeling of the parent, particularly I like to think of the parent in a relationship with a child as having an authority that I would call the authority of the towel. Do you have any idea where I get that? The authority of the towel. Jesus washed the feet of his disciples. He made himself a servant. And I really believe if we want a goal or an ideal scripturally about what it means to be a parent, it means to primarily be a servant. And so serving means I am planted, I'm an incarnation of Christ in that place. I can then try, with all of the frailties that I have, to be faithful to a communication style that reflects that love in that relationship. So then, as we dialogue this out, I don't give up anything when I'm doing this as a person in that relationship, but I need to be aware that there's another human being here as well. So as we do this together, we arrive at a solution in which, if we're going to be peacemakers, the needs of each person are taken care of. But I'm not going to give up on this. You know, I'm going to make sure that I am taken care of in what I need to happen in the family and for me. But I need to respect and have equal regard for the other person as well. And this can be painful and time-consuming, but if we're going to find nonviolent solutions, however much painfulness and suffering, maybe that's part of the theology of the cross, we need to wade through this to make sure that the Christ who is our peace is actually the one who gives peace in our relationship. Mona?
Any questions before we go on? I'm going to be more clear about how you go about it at this point. Is that what you...
I'm going to ask you to take the checkbook and illustrate it with that.
Okay, I will.
You almost made authoritarianism a very word.
Well...
And I think, don't you have to have some sort of authority as a parent?
Okay, is there a difference...
Loving authority. No. I mean, like a benevolent type of authoritarianism.
Okay, please look carefully at the definition of being authoritarian. It says that I want my way, and that the way of the other or the needs of the other do not count. Mm-hmm. Okay, that is not at all to disparage authority in terms of parenting or in other teacher-student relationships or whatever. Authority, surely, is very significant. And we'll define that. I guess I still see authority as primarily growing out of expertise and serving, more so than it does power. But, you know, we could talk about that. It sort of depends on our experience as to what we do with that. Yeah.
Why don't I go ahead and build on the how-to. Those of you who were here yesterday, we had some really good examples of when the behavior was below the line, meaning that the other person was sharing a problem with you. One of the major things that has to happen before any kind of technique or skills are used, and that is you need to get the person's attention. Laura isn't here today, but one of her questions, here she is, hello Laura. She posed right at the end of the class, and we teasingly said, can't tell you that, come back tomorrow. Well, today is tomorrow. And we need to, after we have sent several very strong, skillful I messages, and people still do not respond, one thing that is essentially important is that you meet with them and you convey one more time that although you have shared this communication with them several times, that it's really very important to you, and would they be willing to spend the time to continue talking about it? Because I find that if it is important to you and you do not have time set aside, then the person isn't going to take you seriously and this is not going to be successful. I know sometimes when we have issues at home and we're very busy, it would be better to say, this sounds like a very important issue for you, I do not have time to problem solve with you at this moment, but let's plan it this evening at 9 or whatever, because this does take some time. There are 6 steps to problem solving, and you think, my word, you know, how are you going to do this about the raincoat incident when the kid is halfway out the door? But even though there are 6 steps, they're can be done very quickly depending on the nature of the problem. The first thing, and I think probably one of the most important and perhaps different from the way that we have solved problems in the past, is that we define the problem in terms of needs, not solutions. So that would be the first one. Define problem in terms of needs, not solutions. What happens to us when we have solutions? We immediately get into, I want it this way and I want it that way, and we only see, for example, with the stereo, it would be, I want the stereo, you can't have the stereo, I want the stereo, you can't have the stereo. But we have not really gone back to the primary churnings within each of us, which are very individual. And when we find out what those are, then we can move into, and this can be called brainstorming solutions or throwing out solutions. And what's beautiful about this step, and I think again where we get caught sometimes on this step, is that someone said, oh, well, you could rent a stereo. And someone says, no, you can't do that. So the important thing is that when you are brainstorming, you make a rule in your family or in your communication that you do not evaluate this in the second step. So we have found in our family that we throw out absolutely crazy solutions, which sometimes end up being the very best solutions because they've been far out, and we've extended our creativity to the point where actually that really wasn't a bad idea at all. So we're going to brainstorm solutions. All right, and then of course, the next step would be then to evaluate the solutions. Now on biggies, I would even suggest you sit down at a table and list some. On small things, we find out that we just do it verbally. This summer has been absolutely wild with four of us needing the car, and we all go in places where we cannot ride buses. And although a lot of it has been verbal, and on the run, we have used this method. So then we evaluate the solutions, and then of course the fourth step would be to choose one. And then this is a very important step, and that is to figure out how is it going to actually get taken out, carried out. For example, sometimes signs on refrigerators are important, or reminders, or equipment, or who's going to put gas in the car, or whatever. So you really need to plan and take action. And then what often happens is after we've done this, and it's really creative and marvelous and so forth, we forget to evaluate it or come back to it and to check the results. How's that going? Did that work out for you? Okay, let's just quickly go through the I want a stereo, I want equipment for the children's room. Let's say some of you think like this wife and some of you think like this husband. What would the needs of the husband be if we were just defining in number one? Let's just pretend that we might get into this situation. What would some of his needs be, do you think?
He needs to relax.
Relax, all right. What else?
Needs it for entertainment,
okay. All right.
He's probably given up a lot of things that he experienced as a single person, and he feels a little trapped.
Okay.
And he needs.
All right. So he feels trapped, wants to feel a little spoiled, maybe, or a little indulged.
He needs to protect his expensive record collection from his present inadequate needle and things.
you've gone through this.
Okay, that's a few of the person's needs, and since we aren't the person, we don't know what their needs might be. What about the woman in this particular situation? What are her needs? Here's this money that's both theirs, and she's expressing some.
More order in the household.
Okay. I guess she expressed it. Is the child's room? What would be another need?
She needs a dishwasher worse.
Okay, what about, now some values could get into this, which could make it more sticky.
To teach the children to be tidy.
All right.
Cut down her own workload, perhaps.
Okay.
The need to begin a savings account of some kind.
All right.
Surely in terms of living more simply, you know, it might become a real issue of stewardship as to whether or not this is how we want to live together as a family. You know, so it might be a value kind of thing. Which...
Okay, now we have just a little time and we want to do a few more things. Let's just brainstorm some solutions and, you know, do it with wild abandonment. What are some ways, now in keeping in mind the needs here, what are some ways that they could solve this, considering both needs?
Well, as I look at these two lists here, and this happens with Carolyn and I, we've got emotional stuff listed for the husband. We've got all this practical stuff listed for the wife. And I'll be darned if I can figure out what Carolyn's emotional needs are with wanting to buy household stuff against my being frivolous, as it were. Can we kind of hit some of the emotional needs that the woman has here?
Security, having other people's houses not look nicer than her house.
Making things easier for herself so she has some time to pursue her own interests.
Just be more orderly.
Maybe the husband wants to bring the music appreciation of the kids.
Women, are you emotional about this? Maybe children's room issue isn't a good one.
Yeah, well, I think it is. Maybe she needs a little more privacy, and her children are always on top of her, and she needs to make their room a place that they want to be.
Okay, so you go with the relaxation for the woman idea.
Oh, I can see that, yeah. Well, I think privacy is different from relaxation.
Okay, and privacy.
With earphones, you can add that to the man's list, too, then.
Question, too, if they talked about this before this date, you know, if the matter of the room has been talked about and disregarded, and this is the first time the husband is throwing this out about, oh, I want to get this, I think that makes quite a difference, too. Mm-hmm.
And it's a good sale.
Big sale on that. This is a good issue because the whole business is a value issue. It's also expenditure of money issue, but it is a value issue. And if the person that you're dealing with does not have the same value, you know, the next day may be an antique piece of furniture for the dining room that the other person says, you've got to be kidding. Music is thus and so is antique furniture. And so you get into a whole bunch of values. Let's throw out some solutions regarding this, considering both.
Could you make a family project? I'm thinking all the shelves and so on.
Okay.
Could the whole family work together?
All right.
On that blessed room.
You
divide the money in half and get a cheaper stereo and still get the shelves.
Split funds.
Sure, and then add to it equally until you arrive at something that's reasonable on both sides.
Okay. Charge it.
now you can see right away, now I was a very good ETP
person. I didn't say, oh no, because that's what you might do if you're having this discussion at home. Oh, we don't want to do that. How about layaway for the... Okay.
Modifying the stereo components over a period of time.
All right. Gradual purchase.
You don't get it.
All right, but see, you're wanting to evaluate. Let's hang on to that, because we're just right here.
Would it be considered a solution if, say, the wife said, you go ahead and buy your stereo now, if I can have the next, the next big project? Would that be considered a solution, or would that be a concession?
I think we need to put it down. The husband says, let's take care of the child now, and then later on I'd like to get stereo. But I think there should be some understanding of what's in process, or what is for the future, what are we going to do, how are we going to use our money, what are we going to do at home? If there's no understanding of that, there's always going to be that same problem.
So you would say, let's plan something ahead and get some understanding about our long-range family responsibility.
Okay, more solutions. Oh, come on, there's so many of you, and I bet you each have five.
Okay. Suppose you scrap the whole thing and say, well, let's use the money and go to Holden Village.
Where they have great music.
Once the shelves and the children's room is taken care of, we'd have more time to really enjoy that stereo, so that could come back.
Yeah. So reverse it then. This would be the reverse of this suggestion.
Get an extra job.
Okay, extra job. Who would you say that for?
Either.
Okay. Great. Okay, so you can see, we won't go on through this because I think we could go through another one quickly. But you can see that there are all kinds of ways to come up with some of the needs that are expressed here. Let's see, Jean, how about the two of us doing something here? We have had requests for role playing games. Okay, this time, let's see, I am going to be a 10-year-old child. And Jean is going to attempt to get me to do something, I think.
The origin of this is from Vespers last night, the one letter that the child had written about why is it, addressed to God, why is it that it's always the child that takes out the trash? And so maybe that's a part of the child's misery, just to do that day after day after day after day, and that's what Mona is going to reflect as a 10-year-old. The trash is still over there. I've asked you to take it out before, and I am really bothered it's still there.
I'm on my way out. I have a baseball game. The boys are waiting for me out here. I'm their pitcher.
Oh, now, wait a minute, please. I really am upset because this is the third time today I've asked you to take out the trash.
Yeah, I know, but I'll see you. I gotta go.
Would you please come back? I really need to talk with you right now.
No. I'll tell you what. We lost the last game because I wasn't there. You know, I had this cold and I couldn't do it. Bye, Dad.
I know that you don't want to stay here and do this. Shirley can tell that, but I want you to come back right now because I really need to get this straightened out.
I thought you were doing method 1.
No, we're going to method 2.
Oh, you are. Yeah. Okay, excuse me. I didn't think you were doing it very authoritarian.
All right. Would you like to do it?
No. We have to resolve how we're going to do it.
It says here all three ways. 1, 2, and 3.
Okay, would you like to hear it the first way?
Yeah.
We'll let you help us decide. Okay. You get back here, or young woman, you will never play another game of baseball.
Dad.
Oh,
Okay, method two. Same problem. The trash is still over there. Where are you going?
Yeah,
I really would like to have it taken out.
I see it, Dad, but you know, I have this baseball game to go to, and I'm head pitcher, and boy, I'm going to go do it now.
Look, you've been telling me that you're going to take the trash out, and I look over there, and it's still there. I want to know when it's going to happen. I'm going to be mad the whole time you're gone if you don't take that trash out. Wait till you get home. Okay, that's a form of method two. You know, you can see that she's so powerful and strong, that runny-nosed kid, you know, that she got away with murder, and she went and played baseball and didn't take out the trash again. Okay, pretty ineffective. Okay, now we'll do method three.
Goodbye.
Mona?
Yeah.
I have something more I want to say. The trash is still over there, and I've asked you three times, and I'm really upset that it's not out yet.
I know, but this is the only time of the day we have this baseball game. I'm head pitcher, and they're all waiting for me out there.
I would like to talk with you now about it.
Well, you can hear they're yelling for me out there. I gotta go, Dad, for heaven's sake.
I know that you're impatient about going. You really want to get over there, but I'm not going to feel good at all about your going unless we get this straightened out.
Well, how about this thing is, you know, right at 11:30 here, and I promise you, it's just going to take an hour, and I could do it. In fact, I'll do it. The trash doesn't come till 3, and I'll get that done before.
Okay, I really need to know that trash is going to be taken out.
I promise you, it will be taken out by 3 when the trash man comes.
Okay, well, I'm going to count on that. So you're going to do it at 3?
No, I'll do it before 3. But
before 3. Okay.
Now, what happens if she doesn't do it before 3?
Right.
Oh, then we'll get together again. Yeah. See, method 3 in any relationship does have to take into account that we all stumble and fall flat on our faces in terms of our own truthfulness, dependability, etc. Things can happen that even though when we agree, we're not going to do it. But if I'm the parent, I don't let the kid off the hook any more than the kid's going to let me off the hook about something that I agree to. And the next time, you know, I'm going to be much more reluctant just to easily do a solution that I can live with at the time in good conscience and faith. I'm going to sit down and we're really going to work more on what's happening about the chores, etc. Then maybe what I will discover is that the child just really is tired of doing the chores all the time and would like some other kind of work. Well, that's okay. You know, it isn't true that kids are the only ones who can take out the trash, for example. I take out the trash in my home as much as anybody else because we rotate jobs, basically in terms of what we do. But everybody works. You know, everybody is involved in the livelihood of how our family functions together. So I'm not giving up anything by doing that. In fact, I believe one of the outcomes about method 3 that I like the best in terms of its nonviolent solutions is it really does provide an opportunity for everybody in the family or each participant in a relationship to be responsible. I learn responsibility in terms of that relationship as well.
Question on just that point, responsibility, teaching responsibility. Okay, there's something that you want done. You don't need to name it, but there's something you want done. So you're the father of the house. Okay, you make it known, you want this done. Okay, you tell your daughter, this should be done, and then it doesn't get done. Then you remind her, and she has something else to do, you know, and it doesn't get done again. You remind her again, doesn't get done. And you talk to your wife, and you say, look, nothing's happening here, and so on. In other words, the idea of teaching responsibility, delayed action, and the relation of that to responsibility in the child. I'm curious and interested how you handle that. How do you teach that child responsibility when there is forgetfulness or there are excuses like you were illustrating here, you know, I've got this to do, I've got this to do, and so on and so on. How do you teach that child responsibility in the best way in the home?
Okay, you hang in there, finally, on not only sending the iMessages, the care fronting that we've talked about, but you also very much adhere to the doing of peacemaking by nonviolent solutions. Because it doesn't mean that you ignore then if someone doesn't follow through. It means all the more that you're going to get that straightened out. And when I sit down finally, either as a family council, where we meet together to talk about something, perhaps it's a real problem for the family, or we do it one-to-one, which is probably more effective, then we make an agreement, and then we expect in each other that that agreement is going to be kept. And then when it's not, it is dealt with currently as much as possible, so that we do not develop a pattern of postponement, of non-cooperation, of irresponsibility, etc. And that works.
Okay, dealt with currently. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, you wouldn't let this go on for a week, for example, of not taking the trash out, because you surely then would have committed the frailty of permissiveness. Now, you have to stay current with what's happening. If you're going to keep peace in the relationships, for one thing, I know that when I occasionally I'm gone a few days or every week because of my responsibilities as pastor. And when I get home, there are times things that have not happened that I expected to happen, either in our relationship or with the kids. And I want to deal with that when I get home. If I go home and swallow and say, well, I guess I can't do anything about this, and then I leave another couple of days, I really have been quite irresponsible as a peacemaker in the family. Because the next time it happens, and of course I do this at times, you know, I don't always want to come home and tackle something when I see it. I say, oh no, not this, you know, I'll postpone this until tomorrow. But when I do that, I pay a cost for it, because I find that I build up a kind of anger that often explodes irrationally and is much less faithful to peacemaking than I would like it to be. And I'm responsible for that. That is my sin.
Can you give some concrete examples on how you would deal with this situation if it occurred several days? And other than saying, I'm disappointed that you didn't follow through on your responsibility.
So then you would go into needs. You're talking about the baseball versus trash issue.
Right, right.
Okay, so then if you were to say what the child's needs were, and let's say we were speaking to a child, what are some, you might find out some needs that you do not know about. So when you begin to define, first of all, you've sent the iMessages and they have not worked. You've sent good ones and they have not worked. So then you may find that, I don't like to take the trash out in the dark. The trash is smelly. I'm the only one in the block who takes out the trash. Who knows what the needs may be? Or you always ask me when I'm on my way to something. And then the mother or father's needs are listed there. When you come up with solutions for particular kids, you know, a note, a chart, reminders, a change of jobs, all kinds of solutions can come out of that. And then that's why the important thing is, after all of that, you check back with how well that is working. But, you know, we get so stuck in, you will take out the trash, I won't take out the trash, and you don't go anywhere. But when you can really get into what are all the things there. Well, the trash is, sometimes they go out there and it's all over the place. And because I take out the trash, I have to pick it up and it's smelly and roaches and ants or whatever. And who knows why they're so resistant to that idea. And or maybe sister never does anything. Aha, there we have an issue. That we have found out a need. They have a deep resentment that they're always the one who does it.
Yeah. In answer to the thought on responsibility, I think sometimes that we are fearful. You know, if we don't follow through, if we aren't being put in center. I feel that the best lesson for responsibility is to be responsible. And if you just, like with kids, take it for granted that you're going to have to hang in and find solutions, whatever. And don't panic, because children seem to do what you do rather than what you say. And when they become adults, you'll find them with a lot of your bad habits and a lot of your good ones.
And so you just don't need to be, you know, fearful. When you become fearful, then you get political.
How do you find children react after they've been reared with a democratic style of, in this situation? And when they're placed in a very authoritative situation, such as a school, or say hospitalized or something, those are very authoritative institutions, how do you find that they react? How do they handle those situations where they don't have the input into their finding the solutions and all?
I think you're over-dramatizing the consistency of what we can do as people in our homes. They have both experienced that. You know, I think they would all experience all three methods in your home, because there's, you know, you cannot do method three all the time. You can strive for it and increase your times when you have the no problem larger. I do think children experience authoritarian methods, but I will say they're super sensitive to them and sometimes give teachers feedback in iMessages and hopefully in an honest way that perhaps in a method one situation do not always appreciate. They are really preferring that children are submissive in and following the rules. But I think one of the most exciting things can be if you're in a situation where teachers or they're people in authority can really take the feedback from whatever age they are and benefit from it and consider the person's needs. That's, you know, so
well,
super.
I know they have PET for teachers, but I don't know how many of them actually.
I know.
Mm-hmm. I think that we need to just look at the reality that if you and I participate, regardless of the role relationships of friends or husband-wife or parent-child, teacher and child, etc., if we participate in decisions, we are much more likely to carry them out and much more likely to be responsible. Often what we teach by authoritarian methods, finally, of resolving conflicts is irresponsibility, combativeness, lack of respect for authoritarian figures, or authority figures, which is a term I like much better. And so I think we need to be aware even of the values that we have. I find that in terms of our New Testament faith, this way of resolving conflicts is much more consistent with all of the scripture that you can muster. Even if you say, wives be submissive to your husbands, husband love your wives, out of Ephesians, and you develop a style of the kafale, the head structure of the husband over the wife, and parents over children, etc. Even if you develop that, and you're concerned about the moral development of your children, it is much more likely that's going to take place when this kind of love, peacemaking approach is used, rather than the do it or else I have the rewards and punishments, etc. in my hands. I really think that's worth thinking about. And praying over, you know, in terms of the way we relate to each other as friends and as husbands, wives, and parent-child relationships, etc., in Christ.